From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An inclusive and Syrian-led political solution to the conflict in that country is urgently needed. That, according to the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura. De Mistura's continuing meetings with a broad spectrum of Syrian, regional, and international parties in order to bring peace to the country. More than 220,000 people have been killed during more than 4 years of fighting there. Diane Penn reports from the United Nations.
Since May 5th, Mr. de Mistura has been meeting with representatives from the Syrian government, the Syrian opposition coalition, as well as 39 Syrian political and civil society groups. The UN envoy reiterated his hope and belief that guns will fall silent one day, saying that it is inevitable, as has been seen in other conflicts. Mr. de Mistura said the sooner the fighting stops, the more lives will be saved. He stressed that it is the responsibility of all Syrian, regional, and international actors to bring that day forward and to make every effort to protect civilians under any circumstances and at all times. He said there is a general consensus that there can be no military solution to the Syrian tragedy. Mr. de Mistura said it is only a Syrian-led and owned political solution that can address the aspirations of the Syrian people and end the conflict in a sustainable manner. Diane Penn, United Nations.
Fighting in Syria continues to rage, although it seems that the tide may be turning to favor the Syrian government and its regional allies. Press TV's Bardia Honardar has this report.
Syrian army forces, backed by Lebanese Hezbollah fighters, have made fresh gains in their fight against militants. Army units have gained control of two border valleys in the Ghalamun region. The Lebanese resistance movement and the Syrian army launched an offensive against foreign-backed militants in the strategic border region last month. They've captured dozens of militant bases, driving them north toward the outskirts of the Lebanese town of Arsal. Ali Rizk, our correspondent in Beirut, has an update on the joint operations by Hezbollah and the Syrian army against the terrorists operating in Syria. Ali told us about the recent victories of Hezbollah and the Syrian army in their fight against ISIL Takfiri terrorists.
We have entered what is interesting or what is important now is that we've entered the phase of Hezbollah fighting the ISIL Takfiri movement as opposed to Hezbollah's fighting against al-Nusra. Regarding the areas which were under al-Nusra's control in the Qalamun border region between Syria and Lebanon, around 92% of these territories have now been retaken by Hezbollah along with the Syrian military. That's regarding the territories which were under the control of al-Nusra. And now we appear to have entered into the phase of retaking the territories which are under the control of the ISIL Takfiri movement.
Meanwhile, Iran Wednesday denied reports that it has troops in Syria supporting government forces. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Marzia Afgham described the reports as unfounded, adding that the government and people of Syria, quote, have the capacity to resist and will continue to do so, closed quote. Iran has denied having troops on the ground in Syria repeatedly during the four-year conflict. But if Iran is actually assisting its longtime Syrian ally on the ground, it's in response to a regional challenge from U.S. allies Saudi Arabia and Turkey, who are fueling the war there, arming, training, and providing safe haven to the terrorist groups fighting the Syrian government. So says political analyst Eric Dratzer, who maintains the website StopImperialism.org. We spoke with him via telephone from New York Wednesday.
One of the things that's been completely suppressed in the Western media is the real scope and nature of the conflict in Syria at this point, because, of course, for the last 4 years, we've seen that the war in Syria has grabbed a lot of headlines, but it's been almost entirely without context. That is to say, it's presented as if the government of Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian people is fighting against opposition to the Syrian government, which is utterly false. In fact, What you've had is an internationally waged war, a campaign by various interests in the region and internationally, not only to bring regime change to Syria, but to execute what I would call an imperial agenda for the entire Middle East. And Syria has really figured prominently as essentially a centerpiece in this agenda. And not only that characterization, but even some of the specifics of the war have been completely suppressed in the mainstream narrative. For instance, the insidious role that Turkey has played really since 2012, especially in not only fomenting the war, but in providing both material as well as political and financial support to the terror groups, particularly along the Syrian-Turkish border. And that includes the notorious al-Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. That includes a number of the other extremist organizations, some of which today are branded under the umbrella of ISIS or the Islamic State. And so Turkey's role is almost completely ignored. Of course, the role of Saudi Arabia and Qatar in financing and supporting these death squad networks is almost entirely ignored. And to what extent it is acknowledged publicly, their role directly in fomenting the war in Syria is almost completely suppressed from the narrative. And then, of course, I think the elephant in the room with regard to all of this is Israel, because Israel has provided both material support for the terror groups, as well as providing them with medical aid. And this has been documented by the United Nations along the Golan Heights region, bringing in essentially injured and dying al-Nusra fighters and sending them back after having nursed them to health. We also know that Israel, and this has been internationally documented, has carried out airstrikes against the Syrian government in and around Damascus and Damascus International Airport, all of which are war crimes. But, of course, none of that is discussed. And then I think, broadly speaking, the role of the United States and the Western powers, as we know, the New York Times documented in 2012 the role of the CIA in funneling weapons to extremist jihadist groups in Syria using the Turkish intelligence and the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey. So there's an international scope, an international component to this war in Syria, which is completely ignored. And the reason why I get into all of this, the reason why we provide this context, is because it is critical for understanding the developments that have taken place just in the past week, because we have scattered reports, though they're contentious, scattered reports that we now have direct involvement of Iranian, Iraqi, and Afghan militias under the auspices of Iran inside of Syria in aiding the Syrian Arab Army and the Hezbollah forces. So now you have a truly internationalized conflict, because Tehran, that is the Iranians as well as their allies, see an international campaign to destroy Syria as essentially an international campaign to break their alliance and to weaken Iran. And so now that you have the involvement of Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Israel, and on the other side, Iran and Iraq and some other elements along with Hezbollah, this now makes this war into a regional conflict, one with a regional dimension. One will have repercussions globally. And none of this is really discussed in the Western media, which still attempts to make the war in Syria as a war against the president of Syria, against Bashar al-Assad and his forces, which is an utter obfuscation. If they were to tell the truth about the situation in Syria, people in the United States and in the West might actually start paying attention.
The Pentagon has announced that hundreds of additional U.S. troops may be going to Iraq to reportedly train and equip government forces and unnamed militias fighting against the so-called Islamic State, as President Obama continued to face criticism for saying the U.S. lacked a, quote, complete strategy, closed quote, for the conflict.
We don't yet have a complete strategy. The details of that are not yet worked out.
Pentagon officials said they were working through a strategy on how to train more Iraqi troops, acknowledging that would involve setting up additional training camps and sending what they said would be less than 1,000 additional U.S. advisors and instructors to join the 3,000 they say are currently in Iraq. At the G7 summit earlier this week, President Obama called on the Iraqi government to recruit more troops and take advantage of the training the U.S. and its allies were willing to provide. He said the Pentagon has yet to formulate a finalized plan because it required, quote, commitments on the part of the Iraqis as well about how recruitment takes place and how that training takes place, closed quote. RT's senior political correspondent, Anissa Nouai, spoke with Saeed Arakat, a former UN spokesperson for Iraq, who is now an adjunct professor of sociology at American University in Washington, D.C.
Saeed, were there clues that ISIS would grow into this huge monster?
Indeed. I think when they took over Mosul last year, it was all over. I mean, you could see that. It was clear as day. The problem is that those who are fighting ISIS, at least the United States of America, it did not have a strategy then. It does not have a strategy today. I mean, you know, when the president of the United States says we don't have a complete strategy, that tells me that they don't really have a strategy, that it is ad hoc, basically. They go along to fight the this group from day to day without
Isn't
really
that just
any,
honest,
any kind of fun. I'm sorry?
Isn't that just honest if Obama admits to the whole world that they don't have a strategy?
Why, yeah. Well, it may be honest, but that doesn't mean that you are going to defeat ISIS, because he said that we're going to degrade and defeat ISIS. Obviously, neither degrading nor defeating has really taken place, Anissa, the spark. Quite the contrary. We have seen ISIS expand beyond what was even imaginable a year ago. Even after they took Mosul, they control Ramadi, they control a great deal of the Anbar governorate. Now they have a larger geography altogether than the whole of Syria. They control half of Syria, so it really is a group that is on the march. They control parts of Libya, they controlled an air base there, another refinery, and so on. So it is definitely growing. So the degrading part and the defeating part is just not happening. Of course, the president is being honest when he's saying, I don't have a complete strategy. But on the other hand, when they keep saying day after day that we will defeat them, we want to defeat them, that you don't see on the ground. And to do this, really honestly, Anissa, the first thing they must do is coordinate with those who are fighting ISIS, coordinate more. And that is the Syrian government troops in Syria, that are the Shia militias in Iraq that are fighting, aiding the Kurds and so on, and really addressing the Sunni grievances. So there has to be a more real and tangible effort in that direction.
Obama does say that enhancing U.S.'s training of forces on the ground could help. How do you see that as someone that, of course, knows what's happening in Iraq inside and out?
Well, I tell you what, programs that the United States has implemented since 2003 have failed. First of all, they really basically deconstructed the army. They dissolved the army, as you remember. Then they tried to build an army that was by and large based on nepotism and a sort of ethnic and sectarian structure. That will never work. That's why the army collapsed in Mosul. It collapsed in Ramadi. It will continue to collapse because it's not really a national army. It is more like an ethnic or a sectarian militia. So the whole effort to reconstruct this army is premised on the wrong premise. What they need to do is first have national reconciliation. I mean, real national reconciliation, where everybody has a stake in defending the country. And second, build an army that is a real national army without sort of ethnic or sectarian allegiances.
Why isn't this something that we're hearing the United States government talk about?
Because the United States government in Iraq has been miserably failing all along. I mean, they had a plan to invade Iraq, but nothing after that. I mean, to dissolve the army, the writing was on the wall then, and everybody spoke about it, including myself. I wrote about it and so on, that dissolving the army will, you know, thrust the country into chaos and will basically segment it along sectarian ethnic lines. Second, when they went on, let's say, aiding a very sectarian government like Maliki all along under the Bush administration, the Bush administration aided and abetted Maliki and his program. They did the surge, then there was no plan after the surge. When the United States pulled out in 2011, there was no plan, let's say, to continue to aid the Awakening Council, which they have established among the Sunni tribes in Iraq and so on. So it is. Has always been an ad hoc policy, not a long-term policy, and not a strategic policy, and simply because they did not want to own up to the horrible, horrific mistake of invading Iraq to begin with.
If we talk about today, and you've already mentioned that in order for any policy to work on fighting ISIS, the U.S. would need to team up with other forces around the world which want to fight ISIS. Of course, that would mean Syria. You mentioned that. Iraq as well. I understand a year ago when this started, they were not ready for that, right? They're still positioned as these evil countries. It's been a year. Is it maybe not time to look at that as an option?
Absolutely. I think it's been a time to look at that option since early on. And there were some efforts, let's say, when Tikrit was surrounded a few months back, and the United States actually would not bomb as long as the Al-Hashd al-Shaabi, which are the Shiite-supported militias, were attacking Tikrit. When they pulled out, then they went on and bombed and so on. These individualized efforts are not going to really produce the kind of result that the world wants to see in defeating ISIS. There has to be a concerted effort. There has to be a sort of a marshaling of all the forces of those who are fighting ISIS. And then you go on and what you do, for instance, you lean on your allies like the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, not to aid, not to sort of send support or send arms and so on to groups that are associated with ISIS. So there's like a whole gamut of things that need to be done and implemented in place to defeat it.
There were rumors making the rounds of capitals in Europe that a summit was in the offing between Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, a meeting that some said might even include France's President François Hollande. Reports that the meeting would be held on the sidelines of an EU-Latin America summit in Brussels came after the EU's vice president, who's responsible for the euro, said reaching an agreement was possible within days. Greece has submitted new proposed terms to end its debt negotiations with its lenders. Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos filed this report from Athens.
First of all, we're not certain that Mr. Tsipras will indeed be meeting either Merkel or François Hollande. He's hoping to meet them. He's hoping to steal some time and have personal meetings with these two politicians. Of course, Tsipras will be meeting the presidents of Chile, Brazil, Bolivia, and Ecuador, the vice president of Cuba, the foreign minister of Argentina. But what Tsipras is really hoping to do here is to dispel some of the bad atmosphere given rise to last week by the exchange of these final proposals between Tsipras and Juncker. Agenda for today's meetings between Tsipras and the Latin American leaders was announced only hours after Jean-Claude Juncker, the chief of the European Commission, said himself, quote, it would be a waste of time to meet with the Greek leader. Clearly, still incensed over Tsipras' denunciation of the latest proposal by the country's lenders, Tsipras denounced this openly in the media and formally in the Greek parliament, Bardia. And then Monday and Tuesday, the Greek government sent off an addendum, if you like, an afterword, two documents at three pages each. The one asked for for access to funds, dormant funds, at the EFSF Stability Fund, and the other document precluded some far future primary surplus rates close to the cap required by the country's lenders. Both of these have been dismissed, Bardia, as not credible. Today, we have the spokesman of Merkel's CDU party coalition, Michael Fuchs, who says that these proposals cannot be taken seriously and they do not bring anything new to the table. So, even if Tsipras does indeed later on meet up with Merkel and Hollande, we don't really expect a breakthrough there.
A federal court has blocked the release of the last imprisoned member of the Angola Three after a Louisiana judge had ruled that the state must release Albert Woodfox. The 68-year-old man has spent 43 years in solitary, possibly the longest term of such confinement in U.S. history. The Angola Three, Albert Woodfox, Robert King, and Herman Wallace, were inmates accused of murdering a guard at Louisiana State Penitentiary, also known as Angola Prison, during a prison uprising in 1972. Though they maintained their innocence, the three men were convicted of murder and spent decades in solitary confinement. Woodfox and Wallace insisted that they were implicated solely for their involvement in a prison chapter of the Black Panthers. On Tuesday, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued an emergency stay of Woodfox's release. temporarily halting the ruling of U.S. District Judge James Brady. The appeals court will hear argument from Louisiana on whether or not to overturn Brady's decision after he issued an unconditional writ of habeas corpus Monday. Judge Brady's order barred the state from conducting a third trial, ruling that further prosecution, quote, would be unjust, closed quote. According to his lawyers, Woodfox suffers from hepatitis C, diabetes, renal failure, and hypertension. Although not a member of the G7, Greece was at center stage during the group's conference in Bavaria Monday, and the European economic situation, although barely mentioned during the conference, was placed at the heart of public attention as Greece's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, delivered a speech on the crisis in the Eurozone. He spoke to the assembled delegates for about 45 minutes, detailing the history and nature of the crisis that faces his own country and the EU. We bring you today part 3 of that speech.
That logic now leads us to a situation where the institutions are insisting that in order to pretend further that our debts are sustainable, we have to promise primary surpluses that are so large that the growth rate they're assuming to be necessary cannot be produced, because those primary surpluses are like me as a finance minister reaching into the guts, into the heart, into the substance of the private sector and extracting so much out of it that the private sector cannot produce the growth, which is then essential for this equation or system of equations to be solved. One reason why we haven't reached an agreement is this. Privately, we're being told that there's a logic to what we're saying. Politically, it's very hard for the institutions to come out and admit it. Then, secondly, there are ideological fixations. Take, for instance, the case of labor markets. In Greece, for 2 years now, we have no protection of labor, no collective bargaining. It was all taken away. The result, ladies and gentlemen, is that more than one-third of paid labor is undeclared labor. The labor market in Greece is as unregulated as it can be. 500,000 Greeks haven't been paid for the last 6 months. They keep working, hoping that one day they will be paid. This is worse than slavery. Under slavery, at least workers or slaves were guaranteed shelter and food. In Greece, this is a luxury for many workers. So what have we suggested to the institutions? We don't want to go back to the old-fashioned labor laws of the 1980s and 90s. What we recommended was that we go to the International Labor Organization and we design modern labor market rules, modern collective bargaining rules or legislation with them. Maybe we can borrow from the German model or the French model. We're not asking for anything that the rest of Europe doesn't have. But no, this was described recently, very recently, as backtracking by the Greek government, wanting to reintroduce sensible ways of regulating labor markets so that we don't have the broken down labor markets that we have. Let me give you another example. Pensions. The pension system in Greece is not sustainable. But how could it be? When you've got more than one-third of paid labor undeclared, and these workers are not contributing to pension funds, when you have this complete implosion of the labor market with unemployment sky high, when you have the PSI debt write-down of 2012 that took billions of euros out of the pension funds as part of the write-down of the bonds that they were obliged by law to hold, of course this pension system is not sustainable. We want to reform it. What is the reform proposal that's coming from the institutions? That we should cut pensions. They've already been cut by 40%. 40%. Is cutting further a reform? I don't think it's a reform. I mean, any butcher can take a cleaver and start chopping things down. We need surgery. We need to find ways of eliminating early retirements, of merging pension funds, of reducing their operating costs, of moving from an unsustainable to a sustainable system rationally and gradually. Let me give you one more example. VAT. We're being told that the reform that we should effect as of today is to push electricity from 13% VAT to 23%. 10% in a country which is afflicted by energy poverty. We're being told that the 6% VAT rate for drugs should go up to 12%. Imagine if I were to go to my parliament and recommend that the way out of this crisis is by having low pension pensioners who are receiving something like 300-350 euros a month. That the institutions are recommending that we lob 120 of that 350, reducing by 120 euros a 350 euro pension, while at the same time pushing the drugs that these pensioners are paying for from 6% to 12%. Do you think that my country is going to become reformable? Do you think that I can enthuse the Greek people to do that which they have not done in the last 5 years, and that is to embrace our reform agenda? I don't think so. So what we want, Gesine, to use the term that you disparage quite rightly, please allow us to do our homework. Please allow us to reform. If you continue to squeeze our population into misery, we will not be reformable ever. This government has the capacity to convince the people, a capacity that the previous governments lacked, that we need to reform deeply, because we do. We're full of malignancies in the Greek state. We can carry the people, but not if we are asked to exact even further austerity upon them. Read our draft staff-level agreement, in which we tried to codify the points of agreement between the institutions and us as of last week. And read the measures that we are proposing where agreement has not been reached. What you will find in that SLA, which is available because it has been leaked, we didn't leak it, you'll find a catalogue of reasonableness. Now, read the SLA that was presented to us by Mr. Juncker on behalf of the institutions. I don't blame Mr. Juncker. I don't believe that it was his script. Compare and contrast the two. I shall leave this to you. What we need is an agreement quickly. We need to avert an accident that won't be an accident. History is not going to take it down as an accident. History will take it down as a failure of the political class of the European Union, of me, of Dr. Schäuble, of Mrs. Merkel, of Alexis Tsipras, of Mr. Juncker, of the whole political class. We have a historic duty not to allow this to happen. And what do we need to do? What do we need to do to have an agreement? The press impresses people with tales of complexity. It's very complex. It's not. We can do it in one night. Our leaders can lock themselves, as they usually do in Europe, into a room at 8 o'clock in the evening and emerge at 4 in the morning with an agreement. It will be hard, but they can do it. What would that agreement comprise? Let me tell you very quickly. There should be a list of very deep reforms for the Greek state. We need an independent tax authority that accepts no political interference from ministers like me, but also it doesn't accept any interference from corporate interests. Corrupt corporate interests that want not to be taxed and influence the tax authority. Huh? Independent tax authority. Bring us people from Germany to staff it, even to head it. Help us in that way. Secondly, this is just one example. Reforming the pension system, reforming the tax system, increasing the collectability of tax. We don't need higher tax rates in Greece. We need more taxes to be collected, and actually we need lower tax rates. This sounds a bit neoliberal, but it's true. If you want to increase collectability, don't increase the tax rate, because people then deal under the table, especially in a country like Greece, which is broken down. Sometimes they have to deal under the table to survive. Poverty has reared its ugly head some time ago in Greece. So we need these reforms. I'm not going to bore you now with it. Read our SLA. We can add more reforms. We're flexible. We're willing to listen. Give us more, even painful ones. So that's one segment one part of the three-part agreement that our leaders should produce overnight.
We'll bring you the remainder of that speech by Greece's finance minister tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.